Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another edition of the News in Review, a chance to look back at the events of the past week. This week, joining us on the program, we have author, activist, and teacher Sam Moffey. Sam, welcome.
Simon, thanks for the introduction. Looking for a fun day today. And that's about it. Even though the Browns are going to lose again, it'll be fun to talk about the world in review and with the panel and solve all the world's problems and go to sleep very nicely tonight.
Right. And from the city of angels, we have the modern day's answer to Perry Mason. Ace lawyer Peter Haven. Peter, how are you this week?
Oh, wonderful, Simon. Thank you very much for that fantastic introduction. And it's great to be a part of the program, Solving the World's Problems, on another Sunday afternoon. Thank you.
Okay, you lie like a rug.
Most of that was true.
Well, the bit about you lying like a rug.
You need to lie like a rug.
Oh, dear. You know, I'm right here. I can hear you talking about me, okay?
And from New Jersey, my good friend Bill Conrad. Bill, hello.
Hello. I'm excited to be here today. And, you know, I wouldn't want to do anything else on my Sunday afternoon but to solve the world's problems. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, you're as full of bullshit as the other guys.
I'm wearing my boots.
Okay, let's get on with the program. Ebola it seems to be headlining in the news. We have one case so far in the U.S. Is it a pandemic? You know, should we all be wearing NASA spacesuits when we venture outside? I have different thoughts on this. Ebola hasn't killed everyone in Liberia yet. Well, I do stress yet. Bill, what's your view on this news story?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously it's a little unnerving, and you hope that the government and the World Health Organization are going to do the right thing. The government doesn't have a great track record at this point. From I think we mentioned it in one of our previous shows. But you know, there's some other things that they keep warning us about. Like, they told us that restricting people's travel to between the United States and Africa is going to make things worse because we can't get medical supplies into them, and they come up with all these kind of emotional reasons on why we need to change the way we do things. And you know, how do you sort through all those kinds of things when, you know, if you're trying to get medical supplies to a country in need, don't you think that somebody's going to make provision to get medical supplies there just as part of the response to epidemics? I don't know. It seems like they want to scare us, and I think we need to be concerned. But, you know, you don't want to have things like World War Z and all those kinds of crazy movies that are out there. You want to take it in stride and just do the right thing and not hype this thing up. But I'm concerned about the hype from all this.
Yeah, and so am I. Sam, Do you have any thoughts on Ebola?
Yeah, you know, I think there's it's going to get worse before it gets better, as everything does. You know, but I think that we in America are always so safe that you know, we're separated. Everything else happens somewhere else. You know, we have school shootings. We have, you know, things that we have our own problems. Don't get me wrong, but catastrophic type things happen in Africa, the Middle East, or Ukraine, and doesn't seem to touch home. And then when it does touch its home, it doesn't seem like we're ready to handle it, as we saw in Dallas right away. What I don't understand is, why isn't there a quarantine on Liberia? Why is anybody going over there? Or why are we allowing anybody to exit that place? But I don't know. I just don't understand that. And Bill, in New Jersey last night, that was the big story, the guy throwing up. And, of course, you know, oh, it's not anything. And, you know, maybe it wasn't. Maybe the guy just had motion sickness for the day. But, you know, but the fact he was from Europe. And we all know you know, AIDS got started. It started and it came, you know, that carried from person to person. It was contagious disease. The flu, it's happened before throughout history. There's been diseases that have, wiped out lots of things. Look it up to the Native American by getting chickenpox and things of that nature. So, you know, there is a history of disease wiping out things. There's also a history of the medical field, medical science, stepping up, solving the problem, and such as polio and you know, and things of that nature. So I understand that, but I just don't understand is that since Ebola is wiping out people, there is no cure for it. It's scary. You know, you see people walking around in spacesuits when they get somebody. The one doctor who was just survived now has relapsed, I guess. I don't think we really have our hands on it. And the same thing, the last thing I'm going to say is, and I think you guys touched on it earlier, is the Orson Welles War of the Worlds over the radio effect by modern day media, social network, and whatnot. And I think we saw that panic in Dallas, rightfully so. I mean, I wouldn't have sent, if I had to go teach in that school, I'd be checking, I wouldn't have gone to school that day. That way those four kids showed up. So, I mean, it'd be crazy to do that. It was an all clear that you could trust.
And Peter, I'd like your opening salvo on this.
Well, it's, you know, it's just, it's a little bit scary. You know, we live in a world where we're exposed to so many threats. You know, we're exposed to nuclear threats, terrorism threats, pollution threats. Our food supply is often carcinogenic and toxic to us. And, you know, there are threats from natural environmental disasters, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, tsunamis. And, you know, this reminds us of one of the really significant threats that face people, and that is the threat of infectious disease. And the history of humanity is just rife with examples of large swaths of populations that were just decimated by infectious disease. And I think Ebola is not going to spread in a pandemic-like fashion throughout the United States, but it's because we're concerned about it and we're looking at it and we're aware of it. I just wonder what it is that we may be exposed to that we're not aware of and we're not thinking about, that just comes at us out of the blue. You know, it's a scary thing. I think the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization will do a good job of managing it. I think that people are going to places like Liberia trying to help out with the sick and diseased there and trying to help give them medical treatment and whatnot that might limit the disease. But, of course, going there and trying to do that increases the possibility that there'll be exposure to people outside of those areas. And we've already, I think, seen at least one instance of that. You know, it also reminds me of the degree to which terrorists may decide to take on the next terrorist activity in the form of some sort of biological attack. and some sort of introduction into a human population of somebody who's carrying a very deadly or infectious disease and then watching it spread like wildfire through a population before they can get it under control. It's a much more devastating way of inflicting a serious damage toll than perhaps even a bomb or an explosion. So it brings to mind a lot of different things, and all of them are worth being aware of and worth worrying about to a certain degree, but only up to a point, because there's only so much that we can do about any of this.
Yeah, I agree with you that there is only so much we can do to deal with it. And Sam, there's another virus doing the rounds. I think it's known as summer colds. I can't remember the exact name of it. It only occurs when school opens after the summer break. It spreads like wildfire, but most kids get over it after a few days. Ebola seems to be somewhat more insidious.
Well, it's my understanding if there's a 21-day incubation. Well, that's not the proper word, I think. But I think they have to keep you, it takes 21 days for symptoms to appear, and if it doesn't appear in 21 days, you're home clear. I think that's what I learned this weekend, and it's only been, about a week since the Duncan character came back from, went to Dallas and potentially infected a bunch of folks there. So we're not going to know for a couple more weeks. I'm saying those people were affected, but then, as a teacher, you know, I'm amazed at these kids, especially in the city, the only place they're getting hot meals and whatnot is at the school. So these kids come in and they're sick and they're coughing and hacking and wheezing. They don't have, they can't even afford to get, over-the-counter cough drops. They're always begging for them and this and that. And their parents send them out there and send them into the school. And pretty soon everyone's sick. So I can understand, and I've seen it. I've been a victim of it. I've already had a sinus and an ear infection, and it's only in 1 month. And they've gone to the schools crazy. So we decided it was 19 teachers out, all from sinus and ear infections. I got mine earlier in the month, but so I can just imagine something that's deadly, like Ebola or that super contagious could catch through. Well, one thing I want to tell you, in Liberia, I don't know what I'm assuming, people still going to live in villages and they don't live in big cities and there's no subways, there's no major schools, I don't think it's as densely populated as our country is. So if Ebola gets a hold, or as Peter pointed out, some sort of contagious biological thing, and they set it off in some subway, or they start doing something in a very densely populated area, Chicago, L.A., New York, Boston, Philly, you name it, it's going to spread like wildfire. And I think we have to be, and I'm hoping they're aware of that. And, I tell you another thing. Would they have paid you enough money to go in and clean that apartment?
I'm sorry, hit me again with that.
Could they have paid you enough money to go into that apartment and pick up those soiled sheets and blankets and mattress and whatnot?
Well,
no.
they could pay me enough money because my understanding of Ebola is that it can only be contracted through direct contact with basically bodily fluids. And if you're wearing the right sort of hazmat suit or something, the risk of infection is virtually non-existent as far as I understand it. So, yes, I personally would consider taking that job for the right price. But it does beg the question, though, there are other very serious diseases which can be spread by human contact alone. and you know, shaking hands, or you know, somehow shaking someone's hand and then touching your face or rubbing your mouth or your nose. That way, you can get it right into the blood, the human system. So, you know, and that is scary to think about, because that could cause a very wild pandemic. And it is, to a certain extent, just like you see in these movies. Once some new strain is introduced into a population, it takes them a while to figure out how to stop it. And in that time period, you know, thousands could die if it's a particular type of, you know, really virulent disease.
It was several years ago, but I managed to get what is commonly known as, you know, cruise ship sickness, although I was nowhere close to a cruise ship. It's called norovirus. I look back on it fondly. We're not talking throwing up. We're talking power vomiting. It was 3 days of sheer hell.
Wow.
But yeah, but needless to say, I did survive.
It's amazing how the body reacts to something that it doesn't want to have inside of it. And this whole notion of projectile vomiting is kind of fascinating to me.
Oh, excuse the graphic here. Yeah,
you were double barrel.
I'm sure at one time or another, you know, we've all thrown up. You know, might be food poisoning. It might be too much fun or whatever. But I mean, this really was throwing up on steroids. I was quite frankly amazed, and had I not been preoccupied with the throwing up, I would have made a video of it.
It would have been a big hit.
Yeah. Well, as the saying goes, it might have gone viral.
Oh,
but
look
I'm,
at that.
But I'm not sure that I'm not sure that you can catch anything from a video.
You know, it's an interesting thought, and pardon me for digressing momentarily, but, you know, 20 years ago, if you saw a motion picture, it was highly unlikely that you were going to see anybody vomiting in the motion picture. But it seems to me nowadays, they love to show that stuff, and I see more and more movies where people are actually throwing up and actually, like, film it. It's very bizarre. Just a worthless observation and side note.
Okay, Sam, was that you chiming in?
No.
No.
Must have been Bill.
Okay. All right. And let's move on. I quite frankly have had enough of Ebola. Pretty certain the next time I go to a fast food restaurant, yeah, that they'll have an option. You know,
well, let's just, for one brief diversion, Sam, you must be happy right now.
Why?
Oh, wow. That's great.
That?
I get to tell you things that you're not aware of. That always makes me feel good. Well, there's a minute to play, and you're no longer losing.
We're about one?
No, there's a minute to play, and you're no longer losing.
Oh,
the Browns.
We came up with a new slogan. I had my students come up with it. Cleveland Brown football. What? Every Sunday, a new way to lose.
They are good.
My kids are good. We had a good week this week. I got to check this out. So hold on, I'm gonna take a little hiatus here. I want to hear Bill talk about Ebola and what happened in holy crap! Okay, the charges are gonna work. Oh, by the way, I do have good news. Hurricane Simon is weakening off the coast of Mexico.
Oh, it will come roaring back. I feel confident.
Roaring back up through the Mississippi River and all that stuff. But no, did anybody know? I just want to rest. I know you're sick of Ebola, pun intended, Simon. But one thing I want to ask is, you guys, is, I mean, do you really, you know, when I brought up the quarantine, don't you think that there should be some sort of, I mean, we don't fly over, you know, we know now planes aren't flying over to Ukraine, right? Okay, right. I mean, because, hey, you know, you could get shot down. There's a war going on. Shouldn't we be quarantining people? I'm advising Americans not to go there unless it's, we sent over 3,000 troops over there to help build medical shelters and this and that. And Peter, if you're right, it's by touching people, I understand that, okay, it's not airborne, maybe, or whatever. Somehow... You know, I just think you put people at risk. You're letting people travel back and forth. I mean, it's just the potential for this contagious disease, to come in, you know, indirectly. Duncan, I mean, I think it's a prime example. He's never driven up back into the country, but he was. And if hopefully no one will be affected from him, but imagine if there is a ripple effect of 5-6 people, and those 5-6 people have infected another 10. I mean, there is a potential for it to be a disaster, I think we all agree. And what I don't understand is why the UN, the World Health Organization, we're not quarantining Liberia better and letting people flow. You know, I don't understand. Or the airlines or anybody. Why are Americans still going there and back? That boggles my mind.
That actually is a great question. If we can bomb Iraq and Syria, why can't we merely drop, medical supplies into Liberia? Why do we have to actually land planes? Bill, I'll give you this one.
Well, and again, I thought the drug companies were really part of the big business to make everything kind of corrupt as well as the federal government. So I don't understand why they aren't lobbying to get more medical supplies in there so that something positive can come from this, and for them to then minimize the side effects from all the other drugs that they've created, that the antidepressant medicine that makes you depressed, and the ones that help you lose weight, which cause you to gain weight, and everything else that's been bad press and brings in more business for Peter Haven and his cohorts out there in California. I don't know. It just, you'd think that the common sense approach to these things, why is it beyond our government to have common sense, and why is it beyond the big business to use some common sense to make more money? Or are you hoping for a bigger outbreak so that you can be better at rescuing? I don't know what the plan is, but why isn't there not a bigger focus of U.S. money helping to eradicate horrible things like Ebola? I don't get it.
Good question, and it's one that opens up other questions. Why do we seem to spend so much money supporting people that we really don't like, and we're never ever going to get any satisfaction out of them. That they're certainly not going to pay for the bombs, etc. And Sam, any thoughts?
Yeah, I just think, Big Pharma, I mean, a lot of drugs that don't get cleared for clearance and by the FDA, or these other companies, they ship them out to other, developing countries and use them as human guinea pigs and to see then if they can get things done. And, I would think, as Bill said, new airdrops, Big Pharma could be, donating supplies and dropping them there. It's not like there's no one there in Liberia who can build. They have an army, they have a government, they have people, and that you drop the supplies in until they get under control themselves. I guess, why are boots on the ground in Liberia and not against ISIS? I guess what I'm trying to say.
Right.
We have troops over there, and we have, think of the potential of those troops. What if some of those soldiers, they're over the far from home, and they have a little sex with some good-looking Liberian girl, and she has another chief infected, they bring her back. I mean, there is the potential. There is the potential, to do that. But, again, I'm just for, and I understand, they've got to get profits and all that, but it just seems to me that the best thing to do in today's world, with the world being so small and our technology being so great and the fear of, how about the fear of, can you imagine if 3 or 4 people are infected with Ebola in Dallas, what type of pandemonium that's going to set off in Dallas?
Absolutely. Yes,
just think about that. It is. And I don't think the American government understands how bad it's going to be. They never do. I think they're always, and then the media is kind of, it's going to be a feeding frenzy. And, we'll have if you thought the missing plane was crazy on CNN, imagine what they'll be doing with 4 more people having Ebola in Dallas. And that's it. And everyone will start feeding into it. And the fear-mongering and all that. There's a major potential for a disaster of if more people become infected down in Dallas.
Peter, this has to be an issue. Sure, the CDC is saying that they have everything under control, but do they? Should the airlines stop flying from West Africa?
There are many different questions that I think are being asked when we raise this issue. I don't think the CDC will say that they have everything under control. I think what they would probably say is that it hasn't risen to the level yet where the CDC or the World Health Organization or even the United Nations, if it's appropriate, would recommend that the entire nation or the entire African nations that are suffering from this problem right now be quarantined from the rest of the world population. That is a somewhat, that's an extreme decision, and that's an extreme reaction. And I don't know if that's ever happened in the modern era. And I think that that the CDC would probably say that this is definitely a serious problem, but right now it seems to be limited to a certain geographical area, and it hasn't it doesn't seem to have spread on a pandemic basis to the rest of the world, but we're mindful of it. So I don't know what that translates into. I think there was a report that the CDC did quarantine an airline flight that might have contained someone who was suffering from Ebola. I think I read something about that. So I think they have the ability to implement sort of strategic quarantines to safeguard the spread of the disease. But I just don't know to what extent we would impose some sort of global worldwide quarantine of a specific area. And And secondly, I think that people who are knowledgeable about how the disease is spread, I think they feel that they can, interact with even those who are afflicted and not contract the disease, although I'm by no means not an expert on that. And thirdly, if we're going to provide, humanitarian aid or medical aid to people in need, I don't think it's enough to just, send it down by a parachute. I think we actually have to have people on the ground helping. Simon, to turn to your example, I mean, you were very sick for a period of 3 or 4 days, if I understand correctly. And when you're that sick, you're basically disabled. I mean, it's all you could do to just get out of bed and go to the bathroom. You need people to help you. You need people to feed you, help you, administer medicines, and provide knowledge and information and assistance to people in the local communities. Do this, don't do this, to try to contain the spread of disease, inoculate people with this, keep children out of here, blah, blah, blah. So you need figurative boots on the ground for these kinds of potential pandemics. Boots on the ground not meaning soldiers, but boots on the ground meaning, in addition possibly to soldiers, people with expert medical knowledge. And, it's a different kind of battle. When you're going into a region to try to take on the spread of a disease, that's a very different kind of battle than sending soldiers into a war zone to take on a terrorist enemy that is actively trying to kill you. There are certainly some similarities, but I also think there are some significant differences as well.
Perfect. Okay, let's move on. I've had enough of Ebola.
Are you sick of it?
Yeah, norovirus was enough for me. I didn't enjoy it. In fact, when I realized I had it, I called my boss, and he said, "Stay away for at least 4 days." But let's move on. There's a vicious rumor that a new DC tour company is planning tours of the White House. Now, these tours are pretty minimalistic and quick, but they do offer assistance in scaling the fence. All right, I'm talking about the deal last week with someone getting into the White House. It really doesn't matter if you like Obama or you hate him. He is the man in charge. The people voted him into office. Has the Secret Service completely screwed up? Sam?
Yes. No, I will tell you, it's interesting. My son has been hired by the Secret Service. I'm surprised they haven't put him on board already, but it's subject to some other thing. And he's here for the weekend in Youngstown for one of his friends from the military got married, and we had topic of a conversation. And he brought up a lot of stuff, of course, I didn't know about. And I'm going to share that with you that he allowed me to say. Number one, I did not know that the Secret Service isn't under the offices of the Treasury anymore, where it was originally the wing of. And everyone doesn't know that when the Secret Service isn't guarding elected officials and foreign officials and this and that, especially the president, it is dealing in counterfeit, fighting counterfeiters out there and whatnot. Well, Bush, too, moved them under the umbrella of Homeland Security. And my son has said that has had a major effect on not with the layers of bureaucracy that are now at the Homeland Security. One can imagine all those institutions are now labeled under one. And so there's been obviously a, you know, sort of more of a bureaucratic fumbling that happens, as where it went from being under the head of the Treasury Department now to this giant, you know, Homeland Security, you know, gargantuan. So there's a lot more bureaucratic slip-ups and screw-ups and whatnot that happen. Standards have changed. They've gotten low. One thing my son said is that I thought this was very interesting. With, you know, of course, the Secret Service, you know, is going to protect the president. We all know that, the president's family and this and that. Well, the Obama administration, they, and it's not a knock on them, they didn't like all the Bush administration, but the terrorism and 911 and Cheney and all those people really made the Secret Service, that, you know, if someone looked the wrong way, 12 Secret Service people jumped on them. They had lockdown. There's a button in the White House that would constantly go off if too many people got close to it, or alarms that would go off. And there was a lockdown, like in the movies, like in the, you know, Get Smart, if you remember the opening Get Smart, where the doors would close and whatnot. There was all sorts of stuff like that there, and it could be triggered very easily by someone on a tour guide would take the wrong turn, use the wrong bathroom, whatever. So, you know, the whole White House would be, Obama, you know, Obama, you know, a little bit more casual, wants to be a man of the people, be seen with the people, doesn't want to be like, you know, like Bush was, you know, surrounded by everybody. I understand that, you know, he's more of a people person. They kind of toned down what the Secret Service, they wanted some space, basically. They didn't like these alarms going off. They didn't like all this lockdown. And so the security became a little bit more lax. How else could you describe the president being on a lift with anybody other than Secret Service agents on an elevator when the guy had a gun in his waistband? That's ridiculous. That's worse than the dude jumping the fence and getting into the East Room, as far as I'm concerned. But there's been a lax, and this is what my son has been told. Now that's going to change now. They're going to have to get rid of a lot of people up top who just, you know, one thing that is my son said, they stopped Secret Service. You have to pass this incredible physical fitness test that was stopped in the Obama administration, so they could be more politically correct, more equal opportunity servicing, getting some more women, getting some minority who couldn't pass these other tests. That's now been reinstalled. So the Secret Service is a victim of its own the bureaucracy, more of a liberal rules, you know, where they knew that, for instance, the prostitutes and wherever they were in Buenos Aires. Well, the old Secret Service men were never really taking that chance. The ones in the last 8 years, because it's been a little bit more liberalization, downplaying, that it's more of a bureaucracy, they took the tape, they said, hey, we can get away with this. And it was just a bad attitude there from top to bottom. They did the right thing by getting rid of them. And again, I don't want to blame the president and say, you know, he's responsible, but his attitude of, you know, hey, I'm a people person. I don't want these Secret Service, you know, they're crowding me. I don't want them crowding my wife. My wife doesn't like him. His staff didn't like them being around so much, and, you know, and they didn't like all that. They thought they were men and women of the people, and they wanted to be more accessible to people, to see them, shake their hands, reach out. And, of course, the Secret Service, you know, then backtracked. And this comes from my son, and I think he's going to be working for him pretty soon. And since that's happened, he's been called back into these things. He's got to redo this, redo that, and they're going to have to, they basically are rebooting it, and they need to. And also, at the same token, these elected leaders, the president, their staffers, and all those other people, they got to realize, hey, you know, you're important to us. You've been elected. We can't have the mistake of you riding in an elevator with some dude who hasn't been properly checked out, and the guy has a gun. You know, you're the president. You're important. You have to be treated that way, and you know, and that's
well,
becomes a good job.
In fairness, and you make some great points, Sam, but just in fairness, where did that incident where the man had the gun was in the elevator with the president? Where did that occur?
CDC. It happened a couple of years ago.
It happened a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I thought it was a couple of years ago. I misunderstood. Okay, I'm sorry.
But the more important point was, where did it happen, Simon?
The CDC headquarters in Atlanta.
Yeah, it was in Atlanta. Now, it's still a security breach. There's no doubt about it. Quite frankly, if the president, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, I mean, I have no idea what that building is like, but I'm sure it's a massive office building, or at least that's my sense of it. Maybe I'm wrong. I consider it, or I think of it as a large, massive office building, and there are probably many people in there. And so this person apparently was a defense contractor, and apparently he was in the CDC that same day, and apparently he stepped into the elevator with the president, and apparently he was carrying a gun. Now, that raises questions about whether or not he was lawfully permitted to carry a concealed weapon, and something concerns me that perhaps in Georgia, he is lawfully permitted to carry a concealed weapon. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But he also had a prior record for assault. So, you know, there are a whole lot of things wrong with the whole scenario in the Atlanta elevator. And you're certainly correct that one of the problems is, obviously the lesson from this is, you know, if you're with the president and you're in a place like that, nobody gets on that elevator with the president except the security.
I agree with you, Peter.
But it still raises other issues. Like if there's a man in the CDC in Atlanta carrying a gun, I actually am concerned that in Atlanta he's lawfully permitted to carry that weapon, and that raises, you know, that how else could he get into the building with that weapon?
You may be right, okay, and I don't know about the laws in Georgia, but I'll take this one step further. You would think, maybe that the Secret Service and other law enforcement, the president's coming to visit, whatever it is, ribbon-cutting ceremony.
You're absolutely right, Sam. I can see where you're going, but go ahead.
Right,
keep
going. What I'm saying? There shouldn't be anybody within miles of him.
There shouldn't be anybody within miles of him, but, you know, the president moves around in a lot of highly public environments. There's just no way around it. And, you know, the White House itself is not isolated on some island or some compound in Virginia. I mean, it's right smack dab in the middle of Washington, D.C., and there are traffic and people all around it. To me, it's, you know, it's right in the middle of everything going on in D.C. You know, but you're right. You know, these obviously are evidences of Secret Service breakdowns. I don't think there's any way that you can talk about a man getting all the way to the East Room without it being a Secret Service breakdown. I don't think there's a way you could talk about a man getting onto an elevator with the president, much less with a gun, and not categorize that as a breakdown. But these are also instances that indicate how pervasive and difficult the problem is becoming. The man who got into the East Room in Washington, D.C., I think he used to be in the Army. And so he had military training, and he overpowered one Secret Service person, if I understand correctly, before he made it into the East Room. So it's not just some crazy citizen coming off the street, and or it is a crazy citizen, but it's something more. It's somebody who's actually got some measure of military training under his belt. And this situation in Atlanta, given the facts as they are, I just can't help but think at some level that, you know, this man walked in with a concealed weapon or had the ability to have a weapon while being in the CDC in Atlanta, and that just raises other problems. You know, it's just the population is becoming more and more heavily armed and more capable of engaging in militaristic type behavior, and that's just going to create.
Also, let's add it this way, and also slipping through the cracks of security.
Yeah, right.
I would never think someone could even get close to killing the president of the United States, and here we had it, and on two occasions. One, luckily, they weren't in the house. And what if he would have been sitting in the East Room?
Look at the attempted Reagan assassination. That's a great example, because he was walking out in public, and there's only so much you can do. It's a public street. He's walking from a building to a public street to get into a car. There's so many people around, you can only keep them so far away, and some wacko jumps through and pulls out a gun. You know,
You're right, but if you've noticed how the internet, now the president's, I know Obama's more of a people guy. I understand that. And all the risks that come come with that, and they've probably taken some of the precautions. But most of the time, you see the president's motorcade go into like a tunnel, an underground garage. They walk through the back way. There's hundreds of guys. They make a gauntlet for him, and they go that way. And I guess until this happened, I always thought the only thing I thought about the Secret Service was that they partied too much down when they were in Argentina. That was the worst they had done, and now we're finding out. And there's also, of course, a good friend, Cynical Bill, I want him to weigh in, is what don't we know? And I hate
that's
to say that we'll find out a little bit. We never know everything.
Okay. Bill, why don't you weigh in on the Secret Service?
I'm not sure there's anything I can really add to this. Obviously, if President Obama wants to have a more laxed security system so that he doesn't lose touch with people, I'm sure that they took the direction from him. My only concern is that, are these manipulated facts of what happened in order to, get the current director out of that position because they don't agree with her. That's the conspiracy part of the whole view on this thing. But, you can't protect and you can't cover every possible scenario that's going to come up. You can do your best to try it, but if he has told them to lax on their security, do you keep your job by giving in to the president's wishes, or do you keep your job because something bad almost happened on your watch? What do you do?
That's a very good question.
Well, yeah. The only good thing we can say about all these instances is that thankfully nothing horrific has happened. But obviously, the more these kinds of things happen, the greater the likelihood that it will be a horrible event one day. And Sam, you did mention something interesting, and that was what were you alluding to when you mentioned the Secret Service? I think you said in Argentina.
Right.
Yeah, I mean there were improprieties going on there, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, remember the they were in Buenos Aires. I don't know if the president was there. I think they were there for something else. Well, he might have been there, or the vice president. I think it was Biden. And
they were preparing for his visit.
They were getting a little crazy down there, if I remember correctly.
There were hookers. Right, and with blackmailing.
Well, all of these instances, in recent history, indicate that obviously there's a breakdown in formality and control and discipline amongst the Secret Service. Even if the president wants the guys to lighten the reins a little bit, that's still no excuse for a man walking into the East Room. And I can't imagine the president was responsible for the guy getting on the elevator unless he said something like, oh, let him on, it's okay, I don't want to be elitist or what have you, I don't know. But overall, there is an impression that there's a lack of discipline at the amongst the Secret Service, and I don't know what the cause of it is. But if that's the case, then leadership has to change. There's got to make some changes, and hopefully that will happen. That is happening, and hopefully some semblance of order will be restored until the next agency breaks down with its discipline and its behavior.
Well,
all right.
It shows in. I think that's a key phrase. Need to be redisciplined, and formalities back engaged, and things of that nature, and become the president's bodyguard that it should be. I don't want to.
What happens in the military when we had these crazy, snapshots of soldiers doing, absurd things with prisoners or dead bodies?
In corporations, whatever. I mean, we know it happens everywhere. But what I don't, I think one of the things I've learned from this is that, this whole, now that all the the Bush and the, put all these agencies on the Homeland Security, maybe that has to be relooked at again. And maybe there's too many layers of bureaucracy and too many chiefs and not enough Indians and breakdowns everywhere because we're all under this umbrella agency called Homeland Security. And maybe the Secret Service needs to go back under the Treasury's watch and deal with just what it was dealing with as opposed to doing new things that maybe that takes away from the discipline, as you said, of what's needed in men and women to protect the business.
Okay. This is all well and good, but it seems to me that when any problem occurs in a government agency, there is this hue and cry to chop someone's head off. Secret Service director was... forgotten her name, something Pierce, I think. But it boggles my mind. I mean,
Julia Pearson.
Yeah. I thought it was nice to see that half a dozen of our elected officials cut their 5-week fundraising vacation short to beat her up this week or last week. I'm sure it was purely coincidental that the director, Julia Pearson, just happened to be appointed by Obama. I mean, If they can cut their vacation short, have a quick roast. Why don't all of them cut their vacation short and actually do some work? It's just a thought. Bill. Would you agree with me?
Oh, I absolutely would agree with you. And one of the things that just always gets to me, and I know that I'm starting to get a reputation of being a conspiracy theory person, but truly, it seems like everything that I've read from these true-to-life stories and the fictional-type things that go on in the government, and they say, well, this is based on confidential conversations, and we've changed the names, and the it's a different three-letter acronym for a different organization. But the stories seem to be true. It seems like that certain agencies and certain parts of the government and certain parts of politics, they get dirt on people, and they put them in a position, and at any time they need someone to be a fall guy, they just play the problem that they've been caught at when it's convenient to make things change. And, I'm not sure why, but it's to get somebody else in a position that they really want for either personal reasons or it's to change... it just changed the leadership at the top instead of just doing the right thing. It's the same paranoid we get being general people with having the NSA spy on us. You know, they're collecting all this information, and when it becomes convenient, they can provide the dirt on us to ruin our lives or to manipulate us into something else. And I kind of feel like this is what's happened to the director of the Secret Service.
I don't know who to go to with this one. Sam, you must have some ideas.
Not really.
Not really.
What can I say? you know, with you, I mean, I kind of tend to agree with Bill.
You never agree with anyone.
That's not true. I disagree with that. No, I do agree with Bill. I mean, I just think that I really can't add much to it, you know, in regard to that. But, you know, it's just, you know, from Ebola to the ISIS to all these crazy things that are going on in there. And, you know, here we are with the luxury to the four or five of us to try to talk every Sunday and try to iron things out of each of our own minds, give ourselves some sanity. That's really all I can add. And in this case, Bill made a lot of sense.
Uh-oh. How about you, Peter?
Well, I guess I'm a little unclear on what the precise question or issue is. If it's a question of the Secret Service director being, being sort of burnt at the stake, so to speak, well, I mean, that's just given these incidents, given these facts, I don't consider that to be inappropriate.
No. It's more about the fact that 500 and some members of or elected members are on a 5-week fundraising adventure, but somehow a few of them managed to come back to Washington just to roast the woman.
Oh, well, I mean, Simon, I mean, come on, this is politics, and there's nothing as fun or as rewarding to a politician than getting out there in front of a TV camera and making the news. I mean, that's they will drop anything they're doing and move heaven and earth if they can get a good promo in front of a TV camera asking somebody a question or reporting to their constituents that they attended this hearing and they grilled her. And that's part of why there is this public hanging, so to speak. It's so that all the animals can come out of the wilderness and feed off the dying carcass. That's what they do. They're politicians. This is part of the mob mentality, and it's par for the course. And it's ugly and it's unpleasant and it's completely unnecessary. It's completely unnecessary. I don't know what they're hoping to accomplish by grilling the woman. I mean, I thought she had already resigned, and even if she hasn't, her job's clearly, her head's on the chopping block. What's to be gained by grilling her publicly? Just put somebody in there and start all over. I mean, it's all unnecessary. It's done because they have an opportunity to grandstand and get their mugs on the television camera, in my opinion.
Yep. And of course, we're 4 weeks away from the midterms.
Yeah. It's always a good time. It's always a good time to get on TV. These guys love TV. They love it. They love TV almost as much as they love looking at themselves in the mirror.
Sam, do you think the Republicans can gain in the midterms, or have they?
I think right now it is their game to lose. It's just on my own observation. I think that if they blow it, it's because they've snatched, as we've seen them do, snatched defeat from the jaws of victory many, many times. Much like my beloved Cleveland Brown. It's their end game right now. Their base is more motivated than the Democrats are right now. The Democratic Party is, and it's happened to anybody, but with the Republicans, it would be if there was a Republican president, last 2 years to go, with things kind of, not that rosy on Main Street, the world in a mess. I think that you would see the Democrats seize both houses. So the midterms usually go to the party outside. That's historic, unless there's something unique going on. So I just think obviously it's also very hard to beat an incumbent in Congress in the House more than it is the Senate. The House retains more, has a better rate of getting reelected than the Politburo did way back in the old heyday of the Soviet Union. It was easier to dislodge somebody from the Communist Party than it was an elected Democrat or Republican congressperson. So I see the House staying probably the same, maybe with a couple of net gain seats to the Republicans, only because they're power in power, party in power, and they have more dough. And I think the Senate's going to be like, it might be 50-50, but I think it'll be 51-49. And they'll flip six seats. And that's going to be that. And I think a lot of it has to do with what's going on in the world and the fact that the Democrats are stale right now. You know, just like the Republicans were 4 years, 8 years ago and whatnot. The Democrats are, they're on the defensive on like 32 seats, and the Republicans have got the dough, they've got the momentum. And it's, for some reason, I don't know why, the Democratic base around the country just doesn't seem as motivated as they once were. You know, maybe they have to reboot themselves. I don't know. They just don't seem as motivated. You know, and we all know that the Republicans are motivated by the hate of Barack Obama and Obamacare and all those crazy things. But, they are. I don't understand why the Democrats, and I guess to me is, that the Democrats used to be the party of the working man and the unions and all this stuff. But under this president, they've seen Wall Street get richer and the rich get richer. And middle class and poor continue to suffer. Main Street continues to suffer. And I think that's having a major effect on the Democratic hardcore base. They just say, wait a minute. This guy's the Democrats have the Senate. The Democrats have the presidency. And we're not doing much better. So, we've got Obamacare. Yeah, we've got health care has been tweaked and been possibly a little bit better. Time will still tell. But look at Wall Street and look at me. And that's what I see from my fellow teachers. I'm amazed at how many teachers who used to be hardcore Obama and very Democratic leaning in my state, big time. We have a governor, John Kasich, who's not the greatest, and he's blowing away his Democratic opponent by 30 points in the state, which is mind-boggling. Democrats, just like nationwide in Ohio, just can't get stuck in the neutral or in reverse. And I just think that the Republicans could stumble just like the Browns do. But if the election was held today, I think it'd be a Republican wipeout.
Okay. And Bill, I'd like your comments on that.
On what?
On what?
As far as whether or not we're going to see a lot of changes or minimal changes to the midterm elections?
Yeah. Where do you see the midterms going?
I don't think there's going to be that much change. I think it's going to be so close in a lot of races. I think that there's such disappointment in the Democratic Party as it is, but the Republicans do seem to be making all kinds of really bad decisions. Even though I can say that openly since Gary isn't here today. I don't think it's going to be that much change, but I think that a lot of the elections are going to be a lot closer than anyone would have guessed, even if they're normally, you have a strong Democratic state, you're going to see that there's going to be a higher number of Republicans. The numbers are going to be a lot closer in all the elections. That's kind of the way I think it's going to be. Aside from that, I don't think much is going to change.
That's interesting. The Republican Party are crowing that they're going to take over the Senate. Personally, I don't think so. What would be your view, Sam?
Well, like I just said, earlier, I think they are going to flip to six seats. I just look at what's going on. Scott Brown, the six seats that they need to flip, they're doing very well in. and they've got they don't have Tea Party goofballs running. They have establishment Republican people. They don't have butchers. They don't have people who are saying stupid things about abortion. They've got more established better candidates, and then I think they're going to win. I think I think Bill's right. I think they're going to be tight. I think the country is that tight, you know. But I think for some reason, like I said, right now this could change. The Republican base is more motivated to get out and vote in the midterms. The Democratic base isn't. And if now there might be something that might motivate them. I mean, one of the great. I mean, look at this. I've seen, you know, senators not wanting Obama to come to their state to campaign for them. I never thought I'd ever see that. And this guy was so popular, he raised money. I would say the senators who don't want the president to come into the, much like that happened to George Bush. He's become a pariah in his own party. Think about that. That people didn't even want Bush to come and campaign. They didn't want McCain or Romney to come campaigning with them. The ones that distanced themselves from the president or the presidential candidate. And you see that now with Obama. I never thought you'd see that. They all want Bill Clinton to come in. They don't want Hillary. They don't want Barack Obama. The guy's still got 2 more years as president. He's still the president of the United States. And he's won 2 elections. He's never lost an election. Why would you want his help? But they don't want him. So there must be something going on that their internal polling tells them. And I just think the states that are up, that they can flip, are red states or 50-50 states. Scott Brown will win in New Hampshire. I predict that right now. You know, she's, that's what's going to happen. And I think that some of it comes to the food factor. People get so, the Democratic base is that right now in Ohio is sitting on its hands. And if the Republicans can suppress the vote by just not, the Democrats own shooting themselves in the foot, that's a good thing for Republicans. You know, they can't get their base out and motivate them. It's not a nation. What should motivate the Democrats? Other than, they distance themselves from the president. Obamacare is already done. The health care issue. The only thing that's really out there is, look what my policies have done for Wall Street. I think there's going to be in the Senate, you're going to see some change. In the House, you won't see much. I agree with Bill on that. And governorships, I don't know. It'll depend on each state, and that. But like I said, in my state, which is usually race to win elections to governor, our governor, Kasich, who I don't like, is literally 30 points ahead of the Democratic challenger, who's letting the Green Party, who I'm going to vote, that's who I'm voting for, this one, because the Democratic candidate's no good, it's like 5 points in Ohio. And it's mostly all dissatisfied Democrats. They're just like, because of the slate. So if the Republicans, something could happen, though. It's still a month to go. Something could happen, that could change everything. That's the great unknown about American politics. You know, a month is a long way to go. But like I said, right now, the election was held today. I believe the Republicans have flipped the Senate. Not by much, just by one.
Okay. And Peter. You're a man that spent a couple of years on the Hill. I'd love your comments on what Sam just said.
Well, I guess what we're talking about is what's the difference in Democratic and Republican seats in the Senate right now? Is it 6 seats, 8 seats? How many seats separate them?
I
thought it was 8.
It's 55-40. They have to flip 6 seats. So it's 51-45 or something like that? No.
Oh, I see. Okay, so 6 seats. Oh, so you think that in the midterms the Republicans are going to flip 6 seats. And what's it like in the House right now? Is that something like 30 or 30?
Yeah, it's like 38. That's a tougher thing for the Democrats to do because they've been spending all their money trying to defend the Senate. You know what I mean?
Well,
if you read and look and whatnot, they only made so much. The party's raised so much money, and the Democratic Party decided, hey, the DNC said, look, it's too much to try to take over the House right now. We have to defend the Senate, and so the bulk of their free money or whatever you want to call it, PAC money, free is going to try to boost the Senate. Candidates who are
interesting what you said about the House seats being tougher to unseat an incumbent in the House than it is in the Senate. And I always got the impression it was the other way around. I always thought it was tougher to unseat an incumbent senator than a member of the House, but maybe I'm wrong. Either
surprisingly,
way,
it is the House, Peter. You know why?
Yeah.
Because in the Senate, it's a whole state. The House is just one district.
Yeah.
There's so many issues
yeah,
that affect.
And the Senate election.
That's one reason my great guru, Dr. Joe Binley, told me, and he could give me statistics, you know, that it was easier to try to defeat. But here's the different one. It was so difficult in coming up with decent statewide candidates to be senators. It isn't anymore. It isn't anymore. I, you know,
what's the term of a senator? Senator 6 years?
Six years.
Yeah. So, you know, when a senator comes up for re-election, that's a big deal. And so, you know, there's a big debate over whether or not the senator for 6 years deserves to be re-elected. So I guess I could see that. House representatives, I think it's every 2 years they're elected, I think. Or is it four? I don't remember.
It's
two. 2 years, right, Sam?
Right.
Yeah.
But you see, both parties now get what's the word I'm looking for? They get... You know, the Republicans have learned their lesson. They, like I said, if you remember some of the crazy candidates, Tea Partiers, that they nominated, who won their primaries, to get slaughtered in a general election, they didn't do that this year. They went out and got all the Tea Party candidates, except for the one who beat Eric Cantor in the primary, all were defeated by huge majorities in the by the mainstream quote unquote Republican. Candidates, and they've raised tons of money, and they're just gearing up for this big push, and they're all out campaigning.
To a certain extent, I think the political market, like the stock market and economic sectors, is forward looking, and I think that what they're looking at forward is they're anticipating the presidential election, and I guess. Is everyone resigned to the fact that Hillary will be the Democratic nominee for the next presidential election, or is there still some debate about that?
No. I think you've got. That's a very interesting point. You've got to kind of be an open seat in the White House. You've got 10 or 12 Republican senators, governors, Ben Carson, all these people who may run for president out across the nation campaigning for Republican senatorial candidates. So they've got every day it's a new carnival, the circus is in town. It's just a different ringleader. Could be Rand Paul, could be Chris Christie, could be the Simon Favorite, the Cruisinator. But they've got people coming in constantly with the Democrats, which is what I think is stunning, is that they don't want Obama coming in campaigning for him. And Hillary's out promoting a book tour, not promoting her helping other candidates win. I think she stopped at a couple places. And I think that's the big thing right now, that the Republicans just seem to be going all stops out, and the Democrats just are not. And I'm shocked they may lose Colorado.
I just think that there's a lot of backlash to the expectation, correct or otherwise, that Hillary will be the clear Democratic nominee for president. And I think that is going to cause a lot of people to shift party lines, because I think that's going to be a very divisive election, probably even more divisive than Barack Obama.
It just seems that the Republicans are on the offensive, because they smell the political blood.
They smell blood because she's going to be a tough candidate to get elected.
I'm talking about the midterm election.
What I'm saying, Sam, is that it's forward looking. It's forward looking. Like a lot of the posturing right now for seats and the changing demographic that you're talking about, I think a lot of that is driven by expectations for 2016. That's what I think.
Well, I agree with you. Liv and I, where I live on the borderline of West Virginia, Rockefeller's stepping down. And, you know, West Virginia's always been pretty solid Democrat. The states are going to flip. They're going to flip the West Virginia seat. The Republican candidate is up by 20 points on the poll. The Democratic candidate can't get any traction. And part of that is, as you said, Peter, they were so used to that name Rockefeller. You know, six years, of course, the famous name anyway. Now the person's name, like Joe Smith, and he's getting his brains beat in by this Republican candidate who's rallied against, you know, because the Obama administration's been tough on coal and this and that, and that's just one issue that he's, you know, he can bang the drum, you know, he's banging the drum around, you know, and that helps them, you know, that they're going to flip that seat. And so, you know, I see some of the commercials coming in from that. And, of course, let's face it, who makes all the money? The consultants, you know, the TV stations, the radio stations and all that. And that's where it's going to be. But I do think that you're going to see – oh, I do think – and I do agree with Bill. I think that they're going to be tight election. I think Scott Brown was squeezed by this, Sheehan in New Hampshire. But by you know, they'll be up late counting votes there. But I think this is, you know, and you're right. A lot of it is the posturing for 2016 and rallying the bases and getting all this stuff done. But what I'm stunned about is that the Democrats in these seats are not having the president come in, who's a good, great campaigner. They don't want him around them. And it's almost like, you know, it's almost like the Bush presidency without the economic, or, you know, implications. It's like, hey, you know what? Your approval ratings are 40%. And stay away from, you know, I'm going to support you in Washington, but please don't come into Missouri. You know, just I don't need you there. It's just very strange to me. I just, you know, especially for a guy who's never lost an election, is a great campaigner and a great fundraiser. Why wouldn't you want the president to come in and campaign for you?
Because he's no longer the president in the minds of many people posturing for 2016. They don't want to be associated with a man who's no longer going to be a president, and they may not want to be associated with the sort of person that he is perceived to be appointing as his successor. So that's my gut take on it. There's no point in bringing a guy in who's on the way out and whose successor is not universally embraced. So he's really, as far as his political cachet, he's a lame duck president. He really is. And so there's no currency in bringing in a guy who isn't bringing a lot of electoral value to the table at this point, at the end of his second term.
Oh, okay, gentlemen. Well, actually, I'll ask Bill if he has any thoughts, and then we'll move on. Bill?
Not really, but I just think that that's a terrific insight that Sam had about having no one endorse him, because I sense that there was something missing from some of the commercials, the political announcements on television, and it's right. He's so right. There's nobody has the president helping endorse him for some of these situational issues, or to say, you know, I back them and I approve of this. And so that's just, I don't recall seeing that any other time. There's always somebody that the president is endorsing, and I just don't see it.
Oh, okay. I want to move on. Let's talk football. I know that you'll love football. There was an unfortunate story I stumbled across. Three high school football players died on the field this week. What's wrong with this picture? By the way, in the major league, the whatever it's called, San Diego is winning 7-0 against New Jersey. Did any of you see the story about the three young people that died?
I did not see a story about three football players who died in high school. I saw a cover story, I think it was in Time, or maybe it wasn't, I don't know, but it was a cover story of a man who died, a young boy who died in high school football, and I think it was because of a brain injury or head injury. And I'm assuming that these other two are basically similar. We're talking about head injuries or, God forbid, something worse. Is that what the case was?
Yeah. Okay. One was 16. The other two were 17.
Well, you know, there's two kinds of things. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean they came from different places, but you know the story was pretty similar.
You know, well, there's two kinds of things that you know you basically see as responsible for the death of athletes at the high school level, and one is a very serious brain injury. It's also possible that they suffered some injury that fractured or broke their spinal column, which is which is also pretty gruesome. And the third type of thing would be some sort of heart condition. I don't know which one it was. But it all is basically the way of saying the same thing, which is football really safe, and should we be playing and glorifying football? And to me, to ask the question, it's certainly a worthwhile question to ask, but it's not. To me, the answers are always going to be obvious. The country's need for football is not going to go away, and therefore the supply of it is not going to go away. And in particular, when there's this much money to be made pursuing it, people are going to be drawn to it. And the only good thing you can say is that everyone's fully aware of the risks, because there are serious risks, but these things are just inherent in the game. I also worry about the degree to which performance-enhancing drugs trickles its way down into the high school level. And when you have some players who may be taking performance-enhancing drugs while many others do not, in my opinion, that creates a greater potential for injury, because you have people who are, in effect, operating on 8-cylinder engines against of people who basically have, 2-cylinder body frames. And I worry that that may be contributing to some of these incidents as well, but I don't have any evidence to support that. It's just a little bit of speculation on my part.
And Sam, did you stumble across the story?
No, I knew about the one on Long Island. I don't know where the other two took place, but unfortunately, it's a violent game, and it happens. It's not like it doesn't happen every year. Sometimes there's kids, I remember one year there was an outbreak where like 6 or 7 high school kids died from head injuries, but heat exhaustion and things of that nature by their coaches just running them to death in extreme situations. And one had, asthma problems, or such as that, had been playing. And that happened like about 10 years ago. That was the big thing that they were, and the conditions that they played in. As a father of two sons who played, who won state champions and this and that, it's a violent sport. And I'm surprised more people don't die from playing it, but they're so big and strong, everyone is. But they have equipment. Their helmets and this and that, and they try to teach you how to tackle. And if you use your body in pewter plate, if you don't tackle right and put your head down, you're in danger of killing yourself. Because of the way you can spear, your neck can get broken. There are techniques that have to be perfected, and probably perfected by all the kids who play football, Simon, in America at age 6 all the way up to the pros. Only 3 died is a miracle. But it's a violent sport. I'm not condoning it. I feel bad if the kids get killed. I'm sure they have good equipment. I hate to say this, but, one of the things I coached and played and this and that as a kid is we thought technique, because of that danger of, your neck snapping back or this or that. And at the pro level and they have put in, they've got a lot more rules out there about tackling and leading with your arms and this and that, because people do that, and making that vicious hit is what opens up the eyes to coaches, to fans, gets you on YouTube, gets you whatever, and one big hit, the hero of the game. So I can see where.
Well, I'll tell you something else, Sam. Do you remember something called a neck roll?
Yes.
Yeah. You don't see them anymore.
No.
you don't see them anymore. The pros used to always, these guys used to always wear neck rolls, and some of them were giant, huge tubes of foam that they wore around their neck.
You know what, Peter? I'm wondering if it's built into their shoulder pads.
Well, I don't think it is, because, you know,
you may be right.
Have
you don't see the neck rolls anymore.
They're completely gone, and I think the NFL, which has also been described as the no fun league, basically outlawed them because they made for a hodgepodge appearance. And you had some guys who had things that looked like headrests coming up out of their shoulder pads. You had other guys with huge, giant foam neck rolls, and you had other guys that had these square, pointy ones. Sometimes they'd have two or three of them. You know, you had different mix and match.
It's an excellent observation. I wonder why they stopped that.
Well, my theory is that the NFL frowns on anything that doesn't promote the complete uniformity of a football appearance. And they've been more and more policing this over the years. And that is a, that is something that, in my opinion, it's designed to help, you know, keep you from, it's designed to help keep you from hurting your neck. I don't know how much it really helps in a concussion.
No, you're right. And you know, you also, to take it one step further, you don't see the high school and college kids wearing them either.
Well, they do what the pros do, and if you know,
excellent observation, Peter.
We, you know, you talk about technique and everything, and you know, in NASCAR, you had a guy run into a wall and he died, and I forget Dale Earnhardt Sr. And after that, they came up with these huge head stabilization systems. You know, these huge neck roll placement mounts. You know, you basically, your head is attached to a system in the car that keeps you in place. And you know, you could probably do things like that to help improve that. It's tough to teach kids good technique because they're so young, and you know, they just have habits that are hard to get out of them at that age. If you work on them for 5 or 6 years, you can change those technique patterns. But you know, it's just, the bottom line is, it's just a really, if you had kids today, would you want them to play football today? And I'm, you know, the risk of collision and injury to brain and neck is significant enough as it is. I just worry that with some guys really ramped up taking, you know, performance-enhancing drugs, that, you know, you really increase the risk, especially at the high school level, because if you have a lot of young kids who aren't doing anything and you have maybe a few kids who are juicing up, then you have a real potential mismatch. And it's a, you know, it's a 235-pound guy hitting a 150-pound guy, and you can have some real devastating consequences with that kind of collision.
Bill, I know that your kids are definitely older than the Pop Warner League, but what do you think about children playing football?
What do I think? I think it's a dangerous sport, but again, it's almost we're making a complete circle about people's health, and the sponsors and everyone that's involved in football. When things go wrong in any sport, it seems like certain advertisers come to the rescue and say, let's do some things to improve the safety of a particular sport. I would like to see that. I would like to see some of these people step up to the plate and try to protect, whether they're in the NFL or college or high school, that they really need to step up to the plate to come up with these more protective helmets. I mean, they made some major progress since I played football, you know, with the local park district and everything else as a kid, where the football helmets were kind of, you know, they weren't really as constructed as well as they are today. But, you know, no parent really thinks that their kids are going to get hurt. They think that they've got this all the protective gear, that they're following NFL guidelines and making sure they got the best equipment that they can afford. But, you know, frankly, we need to look at it again and improve the padding. I'm surprised when I think about those neck rolls that I haven't seen in years. But again, wouldn't you like to be a sponsor who said, you know what, we were having some bad football injuries out there, and we made a better football helmet that protects your youngsters, your college age, and probably your father now that they're in pro football, and we just want to know that we're always behind them, and we're going to continue to support and continue to look at ways to keep people on the playing field safe.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. A few years ago in the NFL, I think it was in the 90s, there was a player for the Buffalo Bills, and I want to say it was either Mike Kelso or Don Beebe, I forget. But do you guys remember he got hurt in the head a couple of times, and they made a giant sort of Mickey Mouse walk helmet that they put over his other helmet? Do you remember that?
Yep.
He had it looked like a bowl, and it looked like it was fastened with Velcro, and they took his regular helmet, and they painted it so that it matched the helmet, but then they stuck it on top of the helmet, and it had the effect of creating this kind of, you know, it looked like a big bowl over his head, and it looked kind of silly, but they did it to protect his head, and every now and then he'd hit somebody, and you'd see the top of this thing go flying off, and it would sit there, and it would always come to rest like a bowl would, you know, on it, basically face up. And, you know, that is something that they could do. They could put some – they could make the helmet bigger, or they could put something on it to make it more protective. They clearly have the ability to do that, but they don't – but the NFL doesn't like that, because that doesn't look very good. And they want – and that's why neck rolls went away, because it doesn't look very good. You know, they penalize these guys if they show too much sock. You know, these guys wear multicolored – they wear two layers of socks, and they're supposed to keep the white sock up a certain height so that the colored sock beneath it shows a certain measure. And if they drop it down too low or bring it up too high, they can get fined for that. And so it's all about this aspect is about appearance, and yet you know, so they want to create the product that looks good on television to appeal to marketing and advertising dollars, and sometimes that comes at a loss of player safety, and that has a trickle down effect through the whole system, through college, all the way down to Pop Warner and high school. And the only thing you can say about it is at least we're talking about it so that people are aware, but I don't see it changing anytime soon. I just don't see it changing. And now we're getting to the point where the risks of playing football are so open and obvious, it's a bit like smoking cigarettes now. I mean, if you're playing football, you're in your health and life, and I don't think it's going to stop people from doing it.
Okay, Peter, I don't believe you have any young children.
I don't.
But if you did, would you encourage them to play football?
I don't think I would encourage them. And I also would try my darndest to keep them from playing football at really young ages. I think that the sooner you start playing football, the sooner your body is going to start suffering from whatever negative impacts it's going to suffer from. I didn't start playing football until I was tackle football with pads and helmets until I was in high school. And I think at a minimum, I would try to keep a child from starting to play until high school. If you're going to play, you know, you've got to wait till then. Now, having said that, I just have to tell you that the only reason I didn't play football sooner, and this is kind of funny, is I was too fat. I weighed too much, and I couldn't qualify for the weight limits that they had in Pop Warner football. And if I could have played Pop Warner football, I would have. I loved it. I loved it. And wild horses were not going to stop me from playing, no matter how hard it was or how difficult it was. It was all I wanted to do. And with that knowledge in mind, you know, it's really hard to keep a kid from doing something that he really, 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 really wants to do. So I think that if I had children, I'd say, look, you know, I'm not sure you should really think carefully about football. It's not as fun as it looks on television. And I used to think it was all fun when I saw it on television until I started going to all these practices and it became hell. And it's a lot of pain. you're in a lot of pain a lot of the time. And I did suffer some, you know, mild concussive type injuries, especially when I got to college and I started butting heads with, you know, 290-pound guys. I would see stars. And, you know, I would discourage people, I would encourage them to think twice about it. But by the same token, if they're dead set on doing it, you really, it's very hard to stop them. You might as well let them play and learn the hard way. Otherwise, they're never going to get it out of their system.
Gentlemen, we're almost completely out of time. So I want to thank you all for taking part this afternoon. I'm going to go once around the table and get everyone's final thoughts. I'll start with you, Sam.
Well, thanks again. It was a great Sunday afternoon. Loved it. It was nice not to talk about ISIS and all those other crazy things and talk about some other things. That's always fun. The Browns won. San Diego's winning. I don't know what happened to the Los Angeles Angels, though. Boy, a friend named Darling might be jumping off a building pretty soon if they get swept. But I had a great time. It was fun talking about it. And Simon, as we were talking, a Paul Revere and the Raiders died. So
yeah.
You'll be, I'm sure, spinning a bit. But not many people can remember them, but that's okay. And everyone have a great week, and we'll see you back next Sunday, and hopefully there'll be some left politics and more fun things to talk about.
Yeah. How about you, Bill? Any thoughts for us?
Not really. It was, but it was a great show. I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot from the conversations today. I didn't. Appreciate both Peter and Sam's insight into things that I hadn't even considered. So for that, I'm grateful, and I enjoy participating in this. And again, like Sam said, everybody have a great week, and we're going to look forward to next Sunday.
And Peter?
It's another wonderful day, and I thank everybody for it as well. Likewise, and the same to everybody. And, you know, I can just remember a day when ISIS to me meant a Saturday morning TV show where somebody said, "Oh, mighty ISIS," and I think somebody turned into like some sort of superhero. And it's just amazing to me how the world has changed since then. That would have been in the 70s or something when I remember watching that TV show. God help us all. I hope we find a solution to all these problems. And until then, I look forward to talking with everybody next week.
And by the way, Peter, my definition of ISIS is a small, quiet river in Oxford, England.
That's a nice
renowned
thought.
For punting. But it would appear that, you know, other people have found new meanings for it. Until next week, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. We'll be back again next Sunday. Same bat channel, same bat time. Till then, goodbye.